All right. Welcome to Chad Watch, episode 3. We got, I think, a great show today. We got our old friend and marijuana hero, attorney Matthew Abel. So I'm Chris Silva, and got Kyle Miller, our co-host. And yeah, so I'm super excited for the show. Also, these shows are now available on Spotify. So that's everybody can go watch, I guess not watch, but listen to these shows there. And then I hear Apple is also maybe a day or so away. So we're moving on up on that. And yeah, so I guess we'll get going. I've known Matt for a while, since I worked on the MI Legalized campaign. But even before that, I was I knew who he was just from being in, you know, kind of into marijuana and stuff. I actually voted for Matt for Wayne State University Board of Governors, maybe for the Green Party. Yep. So like I'm an old Green Party person. I was the state chair here for a year. A while ago now. So I've just always kind of known who he was, and then being able to work with him at MI Legalized was just, it was awesome. And he's just a super knowledgeable guy, and kind of somebody who's been around for basically the entirety of the modern industry, and I think would have some pretty good insights. So
I would agree. How about you, Kyle? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I've known Matt for several years as well through the Michigan Legalized campaign. And then of course, spending a couple of late nights down at the Cannabis Council in Detroit, hanging out with all the homies in the industry. It's a place where you really find out who's who, and get to meet all of the awesome non-Chads, I guess you could say, that really built this industry. And so I always enjoy spending time down there. I haven't been there since before COVID, so hopefully I can change that soon.
Time to come back, I think. COVID hopefully is on the wane. Well, hello, everybody. Thank you for having me on the show. It's quite a pleasure to be here, and I don't think I deserve all the nice stuff you said about me, but I appreciate it.
Well, awesome, man. Thank you for being on the show. So I guess I'd like to, maybe for people who aren't as familiar with you, if you maybe want to kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do, and maybe what I want people to know also is your history and advocacy and your experience and kind of crafting our industry.
Well, thanks. 20 years ago or so, I was working as a criminal defense attorney in Detroit, Wayne County mostly, although I handled cases throughout Michigan, including in the Upper Peninsula. And so I decided I was going to specialize in cannabis cases, because while I had no ability to move legislation, I felt that the cannabis laws were wrong. And if I could just get the right judge to agree with me that it was unconstitutional in one way or another, that we could overturn the laws through the courts. And so I started exclusively handling cannabis cases. And back then, the other criminal defense attorneys told me I was pretty well crazy, that they didn't think there was a way that I could develop a practice that was exclusively cannabis. But unfortunately, there was plenty of work, people getting busted for cultivation and distribution and even possession. So I handled tons of those cases. And I helped with the petitions in the, back in the PRA 2000, I worked on those petitions and a couple in between. And then we got medical marijuana in 2008. And I worked on the petitions. I mean, I didn't have anything to do with the drafting, et cetera, although I was involved in the drafting of the legalization initiative. And I think part of that is because I complained so loudly about the way the medical law was drafted, that there were some easy fixes that could have been put into the original language and were not. The thing that always struck me was the way they defined you can grow outdoors as long as it's enclosed on all sides except the top by chain link, wood slats, or a similar material. So that was not clear at all in the beginning. It wasn't clear whether it needed a top or not. It was all sides excluding the base. So is the top a side, and what's similar to chain link and wood slats, that kind of stuff. And so I complained so much about that, that I was one of the 20 or so people that were consulted when the Marijuana Policy Project was writing the legalization initiative. But back when I was, you know, back when medical first passed, all the same lawyers who were telling me I couldn't develop a practice in this area, that there was not enough work, were basically the same people who were calling me for advice about, you know, how is this implemented, and what are the restrictions, and how do you fight it, how do you handle it, et cetera. So we had a decade or so of that, of medical, and then when we got adult use, which we were not calling recreational at the time because we didn't want to have the wrong spin on it. But when the adult use law passed, even before then, when my phone started ringing off the hook with medical, I was able to find some really good lawyers to work with who now all are partners. There are five of us here at Cannabis Council in Detroit. And I inherited some money. I was able to buy this building where W4 radio station had previously existed. And we turned the studio into our lounge. And now all five of us exclusively work on cannabis cases. But it has pivoted from 90% criminal defense to now 10% criminal defense. And the other 90% is licensing work. It involved assisting clients in getting pre-qualified for any of the medical or recreational licenses, to assist them in finding a location, obtaining the real estate, either as a tenant or an owner, setting up their business, and then going through the phase two with the state and getting the facility actually licensed to grow, process, sell, transport, or test cannabis. So we've helped people in all those areas. And now there's even work involving people who have license violations. There's litigation, lawsuits. We've been in litigation with the city of Adrian for several years over one of the early dispensaries there. And that's not over, although we haven't lost. We actually achieved getting our client a license that, even though the municipalities try to claim and say that there's not a property interest in the license, and many of them write that in the ordinance, but the fact is the law says once you get a license, you have a property interest in it. So there's that. And now we're mostly working to try to convince additional municipalities to open up. Michigan has 1,773, I believe it is, cities, towns, and villages, and only about 100 of them have opened up to adult use cannabis. So, wow. And now we've seen that each of those municipalities got tax revenue. I think it was around $50,000 per 52,000, 56 this year per each license, regardless of how much they generate in business. And so, and in fact, the
that's for each retail license, correct?
I'm sorry?
That's for each retail license. It doesn't apply to
each. That's correct. Licenses. So, back when the medical law was written, they got a slice of revenue for any license, no matter what it was. And so some of the municipalities thought they were being slick, like, you can grow it here, you just can't sell it here. And so they cut themselves out of the selling because they were getting revenue for growing. Well, we realized that when we drafted the recreational law and made it so they only got revenue for the retail stores, micro businesses, and those two. Now there are two types of micro businesses. So, but still, any retail location generates the same amount of revenue. I've told municipalities, you're better off having one facility. I'm sorry, you're better off having 10 facilities that each generate $100,000 in revenue, say, than having one facility that generates that same $1 million, because you'll get 10 slices of the tax revenue to do that. And some cities have received quite a bit. When the recreational law took effect, the revenue for medical ended. And so cities that had loaded up on grow licenses and had no dispensaries, then when the revenue started flowing for the retail stores, they were left out in the cold. And hopefully they've pivoted and realized their mistake and are allowing more retail facilities. People are always worried about, what about the kids? What about our tax value of our real estate? And what about driving under the influence? And now we have statistics showing that children are not using it at a greater level in places where it's legal. And the property values actually go up, not down, near a dispensary. That there was a Colorado study showing that within a half a mile of a dispensary, the property values went up 4%. And within a quarter mile of the dispensary, they went up 7%. Because people want to live there, and the dispensaries are responsible businesses. They keep their area clean. They participate in the neighborhoods. And it's really a win-win. And in fact, the more cannabis there is in a society, it seems to me, the less more harmful substances are there. So there's less alcohol and over drinking and less opiates. Cannabis really is an exit drug. It helps people get off of things that they have problems with. Not that people can't have problems with cannabis, but it's a very small slice of people who do have that cannabis problem.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that actually kind of segues into something I was thinking about, a question I wanted to ask you. Me and Kyle and our buddies, we talk oftentimes about like the good old days, you know, of the caregiver stores and how that
Wild
was.
Wild West, Lance, yeah, today, shout out.
Yeah, like 90 stores in Lansing, you know.
Right.
When you
300 in Detroit at one.
Yeah,
point.
That's wow. Amazing, right? And so when you think about those folks and those people who are operating, who are trying to transition into the metric market, as the industry's been created and as legalization is rolled out, like definitely there's highly capitalized groups that have pretty sophisticated methods to acquire property and do all sorts of things to maybe game these municipal ordinances. You know, a lot of these ordinances are in very competitive markets for retail. Maybe there's certain points that you get for capital improvements and for, you know, like your employment plan and stuff like that. And I know in Lansing they're talking about, hey, all these people made all of these promises and got all these points and then got these licenses, but like, has anybody thought to go around and check and say, hey, how many employees do you have that are paid this much money, or how much money did it actually cost to build all this shit? Because you guys said it cost this much. And if you know what I'm saying, if they're wrong on it, like some other entrepreneur didn't get that license and it was probably a legacy operator. So I guess like, how do you,
in most cases.
So how have you seen that kind of play out? And I don't know, like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would agree with you that the legacy operators, the people that I was buying cannabis from 20 years ago, are not generally the same people who are getting the licenses. And that's unfortunate, but it's a reality in today's world where there's a system set up, someone is going to try to find a workaround. And so that's a big concern. And I mean, Redemption Cannabis is one of the real few that's owned by somebody who was busted, incarcerated, and came out okay on the other side of it. But I think Ryan is the exception, not the rule there. And there are a lot of other people who could use a leg up, who have been negatively affected by the cannabis laws, and who still aren't out there. They might have the knowledge and ability to grow really good cannabis, but they don't really want to go to work for one of the large operators. They would prefer to
work with an OG,
keep a cottage industry, if you will. They were doing okay before, and once they got out, they went right back to growing in their basement, say. Seems to me that we ought to allow cannabis in the market regardless of where it's grown, as long as it can pass testing.
I agree.
That's, you know, it goes into metric and no big deal there. It seems like the big boys want to put the smaller operators and the caregivers out of business. And, you know, if they're that threatened by 20,000 people growing in their basement, maybe they just ought to grow better bud at a better price. Because the problem is not the caregivers. The problem is talent in the industry. And really, the people growing in their basement know how to grow good cannabis, maybe not on the scale that some of the large operators are, but the quality is generally better from the smaller operators. And I think we're going to see with the micro businesses, I think we're going to see some really good craft cannabis available at micro businesses. But you can only own one of those micro businesses, and you can't own a part of anything else. So if a large operator likes a product from a micro business, I guess they could buy some clones or something like that, perhaps. And
how impactful do you think the new updated micro business law will be? And do you anticipate at some point maybe those larger people that you just mentioned simply acquiring the micro businesses? The micro business comes out with a really good product that's really well branded, but they obviously can't expand to multiple locations. And then some of these larger operators say, you know, we'll take this same brand and put it on a larger statewide scale and just scoop you up and turn this into one of our retails. Do you anticipate something like that happening maybe down the line?
I think certainly that's possible. Sure. Especially as, I mean, one of my concerns is that the large growers are going to undercut the price. They're going to even
that's
take
already
a
happening.
Loss.
Right? $900 a pound is not sustainable for a small grow.
Right. And so they're trying to put the small grows out of business just by economics, by price pressure. Mm-hmm. Although there are people who will pay a premium for premium weed.
Sure.
And rightly so. And hopefully that will stay. One of the reasons that I think the state set up the Class A micro business is it doubles the quantity of plants from 150 to 300 plants. There's also, though, kind of a squirrely thing in that Class A micro business, in my view, which is that it'll previously the regular micro business couldn't buy from any other processor anywhere. They couldn't buy from a grower, can't buy from a processor. They can only deal with their own 150 plants. Well, now the Class A's have 300 plants, but the other part of that is they can purchase, acquire infused products from
normal processor.
Mm-hmm. Right. So some of them, they might not even grow plants. They're just going to be stores where you can't buy bud unless it's infused. But you'll be able to buy gummies and cookies and liquids, beverages, and all of those things. And I think people are definitely going to pervert that rule to just be a retailer that doesn't have bud, except they're going to, if you want to buy a pre-roll, you can't. So you're telling me I can't buy a straight pre-roll at a Class A micro business, but I can buy an infused pre-roll at a micro business? That doesn't make any damn sense. And so some of these micro businesses, if they know they can't sell any bud except the bud they have, they're just going to infuse it with enough to call it infused, you know, with a tiny amount. Frankly, I like my cannabis straight. I don't want joints that are infused with oil. Cannabis is good enough, it's good enough. And I don't want to smoke oil particularly. If I did, I'd use a vape pen, you know. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out. The city of Detroit just set up in their new ordinance 30 micro business licenses. 15 will be straight, 15 will be equity licenses to people who qualify as social equity candidates. But it's not clear to me that these are, whether these are regular micro businesses, because that's the only thing we had when this ordinance was drafted. The final rules came out just a couple of weeks before the city finalized this ordinance. And so I don't know whether any Class A micro businesses are going to be allowed in Detroit under, you know, how they interpret these rules, or if they're going to go back and be more specific.
That was one of my next questions. I was going to ask, for the ones that are currently operating, does their municipality have to go back and then update their ordinance to allow this Class A, and then they have to apply for a new license to switch over, or how does that work?
I think so, yes. If they want to be a Class A, first of all, they have to get the municipality to approve Class A's and either set a number or no cap, and then determine zoning. I'm assuming it would be the same as the zoning for the traditional micro businesses. And then the company will have to file a micro business Class A application, which is a little different from a standard micro business application. Yep. So it'll require
another round. Stage is created, work for attorneys for another 24 months.
Right, at least.
Yeah, no. So I guess speaking of the Detroit ordinance, you know, that people paying, you know, so the entire industry is looking at this, Matt, you know, so like I read an article the other day that was saying that this could open up the retail footprint by like a quarter or something like that, at like 25% more stores. And like, so like we've all been kind of touching on, the big guys, they're trying to run people into the ground on pricing, right? And one thing too that we should also point out, and we're going to do a Chad Watch episode about retail pricing. These stores, some of these greedy fuckers, man, like, you know, I know what they're buying stuff for. You know, like I was purchasing for a dispensary. Kyle, you purchased for a dispensary. Yeah. I have a LeafLink account. I'll see what they're buying stuff for, and then I'll see what they're selling it to like customers for. Like, it is insane. It is like crack cocaine money, Enron money. It is not like old school drug dealing money. It's super fucked up. And that's what makes the race to the bottom on the price stuff even more, because these guys, oh man, just fucking greedy. But anyways,
and right now though, Chris, not to defend them necessarily, but you have to consider they have all of the 280E tax burden where they can't deduct labor and advertising and that kind of thing.
Yep.
So they take a bigger hit. And that's why the federal law changes. Who knows what that'll be 5 or 10 years, but when the federal law changes, these retailers especially will be able to make more money, or have be able to cut their expenses by deducting those expenses from their taxes. So I don't know how much that plays into it. I mean, if they're killing it anyway, what's the difference whether they can deduct, you know, labor and utilities and that kind of thing?
No, it's definitely not lost on me, because you know, so I used to manage for a store that was a single, you know, one-off retail. We weren't vertical or anything, so that's not lost on me. You know, I just think some of these folks are getting like insane. But the point I guess I was going for here is that with all of this stuff going on with price and the market getting pretty intense for people that are doing wholesale, everybody's looking at Detroit because this opens up, you know, 25% more stores for the wholesalers. And I know the people in Detroit and the stores are definitely looking at this. And so the idea is that this ordinance is going to hit next week, but a lot of people are talking about the potential for litigation. I mean, this has always been kind of the deal in Detroit, is that it's a it's got all these little potential bomb places in the ordinance for people to make a claim for litigation. And that oftentimes happens in these like ultra competitive municipalities, especially one that has the social equity component. That's super, Brads and Chads don't like that, you know. So what do you think realistically is going to happen in Detroit? And I guess I just curious how you see that playing out, and like whether this is like a done deal, or if this could still get messy.
Well, no one has yet sued under the new Detroit ordinance, as far as I'm aware, although I've talked to people who think that it's inevitable. I don't know that it is, but that certainly could happen. This ordinance is probably less likely to be struck down than the previous ordinance, which really the issue there is whether you can limit licensing to locals, to people who live there. And there are U.S. Supreme Court decisions saying that's not constitutional. And so Detroit is trying to find a way both to do that and to not violate the Constitution. I don't know whether this ordinance that's passed will meet that standard or not. They're setting aside half of the licenses for equity candidates. Now, previously, Detroit had their own legacy program, and they're still using that, but not for licensing. Legacy program is going to entitle people to assistance, maybe some preference in purchasing property from the city, although it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of property. But they did fall back to the state social equity certification for determining who is eligible for this. So you don't have to live in Detroit to be eligible as a social equity candidate. You can live in any of the 100 or so municipalities that have been designated by the state as social equity qualifying. So there's that. It's certainly, well, and, you know, Detroit said they would like to begin accepting applications on 420, but they also have said, at least Councilman Tata said that, but they've also said they really need 90 days to set up the program and determine how the scoring system will work and all of that. I've never been a fan of caps. Numerical caps. I think if you want to cap things, you could do it through creative zoning ways. But the problem with the caps is that somebody has to determine who is best suited under the law. And the person best suited often is, you know, the nephew of the council member kind of thing. No, just kidding. But partly. But it allows too much room for hanky-panky. At least the city is looking to outsource this determination. The cities that have done it on their own tend to have a heavy hand or a thumb on the scale and have been sued over that. And so there's been a lot of learning on the part of the municipalities that they're better off outsourcing it to, say, an accounting firm. Who can just score these according to whatever the rubric is determined. There are also some things, though, that a lot of municipalities put things in there like, you know, you get points if you've contributed, if you've been a business owner in the local community, or if you've contributed to some nonprofit or something like that. And I don't think that necessarily has anything to do with determining who's best suited. The fact that somebody might have run a business and somebody else didn't doesn't mean the one who didn't is any less qualified.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's crazy because a lot of these chads are all, you know, and any other issue but marijuana, they're like, oh, we'll let the market have it play out, you know, like rich dad, poor dad, you know, like that kind of bullshit. Like
Kiyosaki, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? But like whenever it comes to marijuana, they're like, well, wait a minute. Hold on. Let's make sure this guy's got $250,000 in the bank. Let's make sure he had another business. You know what I mean? So it's weird that that's when all the gate checking comes.
Right. And they say they want to make sure that these businesses can be successful, but that's not the way the real world works.
Not at all.
Besides, if they fix up a facility and then they end up going out of business, at least they will have fixed up a building in the city and some other business, cannabis related or not, can come in and use that. Detroit has way too many underutilized or non-utilized buildings. You drive down any main road and there are boarded up storefronts. That's not a dynamic city that has that kind of situation.
Yeah, it's crazy that people don't want to do just encourage anything that does anything to make just any part of town a little bit better anywhere. You know what I mean? It's nuts. So one of the questions on this that I think about a lot is what is this ordinance like? Let's say it's not going to get challenged, and let's say it never gets challenged, and it just gets rolled out. What does it mean for the people that are operating now in Detroit? Like, how just the way that the ordinance works out, is it going to work out that a lot, like some of these folks, or maybe a lot of them don't get a license, or is
well, I think most of them probably will get a license. One of the hitches in the ordinance, and I believe it's in the final version, is that you can only own one of these facilities or own part of one of these facilities. And there are people who own, who have multiple interests, have, you know, 1 or 5 or 10% in several locations. There are also some dispensaries that have multiple locations by the same owner. So we have yet to see how that's going to work out. And maybe they'll end up being forced to sell. Maybe they'll sue over it, saying, well, you gave us medical licenses. And there is a clause in the adult use that could be read to say, if you gave us a medical license, you can't stop us from getting an adult use license if they're available. But I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of room for litigation there and how that goes. I think the city is being timid about it. They act like, you know, the 2,000 bars in the city of Detroit or liquor stores are not the problem here, that the dispensaries are going to be the problem. And they say you can't have a dispensary within 1,000 feet of a liquor store. Doesn't make any sense. And or 1,000 feet of a church. I mean, the schools I get, the parks I get, but I don't think that's appropriate either. Yeah. If I was writing the ordinance, I would have just said, you can't do it within 500 feet of a school, period. It's interesting about the advertising laws too. They say you can't put a joint or a leaf on an advertisement. Well, driving down the freeway, you might not see an entire leaf, but you see part of a leaf hanging over the billboard, you know, with the tips of the leaves. Seems to me that's not exactly complying with the law, but there's a lot of a shakeout yet to happen in all of this. The new administrative rules have only been in effect for a few weeks, and so there's a long way to go here. And as I said, there are a lot of municipalities that haven't done anything yet, so we're hopeful that they'll sign on.
I think you're on mute, Matt. Yep, there
got
you
it. So,
well, cool. You got a question? So, I have, I guess something I also with your experience in Detroit in that area, something that I wonder about with this too is, what do you see as the If you're a caregiver, let's say you've been trapping the Russell Industrial or something, you know, like you've been doing this for a while, and you're looking at this ordinance, where do you see the most opportunity? And like, and other than like this kind of shitty ordinance, which it sounds like on the spacing and stuff, you know, just on the face of it, that's not awesome, you know. Other than those challenges, like what's that road look like for somebody who's maybe been caregiving for, you know, 7-8 years, they've got maybe clean money set aside for it. You know, maybe they've had a straight job the entire time and they're looking to, do you think that's happening a lot? Or do you think a lot of these people were already able to navigate that under the medical ordinances? Like what do you see as the trajectory for like that small operator part of the segment in Detroit?
Well, the caregivers who are going into the industry are going in as owners and probably more of them are going in as employees, which is a little bit unfortunate. hopefully they're going in with the ability to become owners, to, you know, after they've worked for a period of time, to get a share in the business. To eventually have a share in the business. I think the micro businesses are ideally suited for caregivers. The problem is they're so limited. Although in Detroit, I mean, certainly there's going to be a rush, a push for the retail dispensary licenses, the retail stores. As far as the micro businesses, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think because if they allow Class A micros under this micro business ordinance licensing, that there will be a big push for people to have those Class A's more than the regular micro businesses, because the Class A's, again, are going to be able to sell all the branded products.
Right, and that's going to be huge in Detroit.
Yes, it will. And maybe they'll eventually see that, that it's working out really well, and they'll expand the number of micros. But I'm really looking forward to the regular micro businesses that are growing craft cannabis on a small level. It's going to be hard to build a world-renowned brand with that, but you don't need that. You just need a brand that's known locally. Like a local brew pub, if you will. You know, Atwater Beer grew from being the place down the block to being owned by Molson Coors. And yeah, it took them 20, 25 years, but that could happen to some of these micros.
Sure. Yeah. That's kind of what I was alluding to earlier when I had mentioned the larger guys kind of scooping up these micro brands. I think that, you know, it might come to that at some point.
Yeah, I think about that too a lot, Kyle. And, you know, something I just want to add on that before I let you wind us down is something I think about with the micros, like a ray of sunshine here, is like, I agree. I think the big guys will try to like encroach that. I think that our laws are set up to make that a little bit more difficult. You have to do another layer of bullshit. But I think that there's probably an opportunity for someone to do, like, I'll give you an example, like a I'm sure that there are breweries that sell, you know, commercial wholesale, like microbreweries that sell commercial wholesale beers to maybe other bars or liquor stores and stuff, but they only have like certain brews that they do at their own microbrew, wherever they are. So I could see like sophisticated micros, like, so I think of somebody like, you know, who would be great for this is if he wasn't with Glorious, like Superior, like Michigan Made Melts. He's my great example for this. Like, he could have like the Michigan Made Melts store, right? His retail and his micro, and have all of his like the super fire stuff. And then maybe work out a licensing deal with somebody who's a larger cultivator who can put that brand in a bunch more stores, you know? And so maybe there's five or six strains that everybody can buy on the normal metric market, but there's two or three like the super fire ones are only at his store. So sure. I think There's some opportunity,
and you could only get over on at Bell's.
Right, exactly. That's actually where I got that idea from. Right, was Oberon. So like, so I think there's a model there, you know, and there's a way for people to bootstrap into the micro, something relatively more obtainable, and if they have a good brand, and if they're creating a quality sought after product, and they know what they're doing, like they can really leverage that into some good opportunities without necessarily having to do it the traditional way. So
interesting. Cool.
It's going to be an interesting few years here.
Yeah. Yeah. The next couple of years we'll see, you know, a lot of brands come to market, and then eventually some acquisitions and, but
right.
I think the best ones, my hope is that the best ones can stick around and some of the bigger guys fall off.
So, right, and then the innovators are going to have to start mushroom companies or something.
The next frontier.
Right. Next frontier.
Interestingly Excellent. Enough, no shit, before we leave, a final announcement on Thursday in Grand Rapids, the committee that's trying to decriminalize ethnogenic drugs. Chadwatch is actually sponsoring one of their events on Thursday at the Wealthy Street Theater. It's a showing of Fantastic Fungi. So for all of you innovative Chads and former legacy operators who want to get in on mushrooms, now's probably a good time to start collecting signatures. Yeah, start collecting signatures. Like, real talk, this is how you, if you're going to be in the beginning of the industry, it's a good time. It's good to be like to be able to say, hey, I legitimately collected, you know, a few hundred signatures and, you know, did my part, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So cool. Well, thank you so much, Matt, for joining us today. We'll definitely have to have you on in the future. Maybe 6 months from now or whatever, we'll be able to look back on Detroit and see where the market's come, how it played out, who was right, who was wrong, and how, you know, things are going to unfold from there. But hopefully it's not caught up in court still in 6 months, but we'll see how that goes. But
it'll be good to catch up. Yeah, thank you for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
No problem.
Cool. Thank you so much, Matt. We really appreciate
it. Man. Yep, we appreciate it. Until next time, this has been Chad Watch.
Thanks, everybody.